we had an extensive training program in our hotels, and we liked ambitious people, people who wanted to learn more about the business and move up the ladder. Probably the best example of that was a young man named Kevin Kilcary, who started as a bellhop.
How do you spell the last name?
K-I-L-K-A-I-R-Y. Yeah. And he started as a bellhop at Greentree. And I remember he came up to me one day. He was a very good bellhop. He said, Mr. Fine, he said, I'd like to be a manager someday. He says, what can I do? So I told him I'd look into it. And I talked to some of the people at the hotel. And they said, he's a pretty smart fellow, hard worker. If he wants to be a manager, he'd have to start as an assistant catering service manager, helping in the banquet area. But he would make less money because bellhops get a lot of tips. So I told him that he could have that job, but he would make less money, and he said he wanted the job anyway, and he did it. And he eventually became a general manager for us. And then he became a division manager, where he managed a group of managers. And although I don't own the company anymore, he's president of Interstate Hotels now.
Isn't that what a story?
And there were many other people that moved up the ladder that way.
When did you think of yourself truly as in the hotel business and not as...
Well, I mentioned earlier that at the beginning, Ed and I were still in the law, maintained our law practice. But in the early 70s, after we started doing Marriott hotels, we realized this was a serious business, and we had no time for anything else, and we gave up the law practice at that time.
That
would have been sometime in the early 1970s. I don't remember exactly. Actually, I think Ed had a harder time doing that than I did. Ed really liked being a lawyer. And at that time, I had kind of lost interest in being a lawyer.
Was your friend Stone involved in this at all?
No, Bob was a law partner.
Yeah.
Bob was
I know what you mentioned
partner.
Before.
Yeah.
Describe your relationship with Ed as partners.
Well, we were partners in the law business first, and that was probably in the mid-1950s. So we were partners for a long, long time. Actually, as a lawyer, I always advise people to be very cautious about entering partnerships, because I saw for my practice of law, that partnerships usually didn't work very well. They're sort of like marriages, only even tougher. And frequently there were differences between partners and litigation. And when people would tell me they wanted to start a business with a partner, I might suggest to them that they hire an employee rather than do it partnership form. But Ed and I had a very unique partnership. We really had different strengths and weaknesses, and our temperaments meshed together very well. We had complete trust in each other, and there was never any reason not to have that kind of trust. And it was probably one of the best partnerships that you would ever find.
That's very special.
It really was.
Are there any suggestions for other people?
Well, I think, again, I use the analogy of marriage. I think you want to be sure that you got it right at the beginning, that you're compatible, that, you know, you're the kind of people that can... Can work together and be together and be flexible and total control. And if you're that way, then you have a better chance of making a partnership work. But we never really divided our function, our duties by function, because we both kind of did everything. But Ed was sort of Mr. Outside, and I was sort of Mr. Inside. Ed was a better people person than I was. And he had a more natural facility for working with people and making friends. And I was more reserved, and I was more concerned with strategic issues and financial issues. So there was a good blend between us. In the days when we were syndicating, Ed was a great salesman. He was able to raise a lot of money. And that was something that I didn't really like to do very well. So we always managed to approach any given business issue from a different point of view, and that made what we did more effective.
Did you ever think you would have the kind of success that you've had?
We sort of approached everything we did one step at a time. Never sat down, had a grand design. And when we did something, we certainly had confidence in what we were doing. And we thought it would work. One deal at a time.
Ed had a heart attack.
Ed had a heart attack while he and I were playing tennis in 1987.
That long ago already.
Right.
Wow.
We were at the Green Tree Racquet Club. Actually, I had scheduled a tennis game with one of the other people in the office. And when Ed came into work that morning, he said, I'm going to play tennis with you instead of Chet. And I said, fine. So we went over to the Green Tree Racquet Club, and we were playing singles. And about 45 minutes into the game, I was due to serve. And just as I was getting ready to serve, Ed said, hold it. And I bounced the ball, and when I looked up, he was flat out on the court. And we called the tennis pros, and they administered
CPR.
The ambulance was there in less than 5 minutes. We took him to the hospital, but nothing was able to revive him. And that's how it ended.
Shortly after that, the business, you sold the business?
No, we had a buy-sell agreement. Ed and I had always agreed that if something happened to one of us, the other would buy out his interest. And that's what happened. And then the business went on from there. The company wasn't sold out until 1998. So I operated the business myself.
Was that difficult?
It was. It required a lot of adjustment. I certainly missed Ed a great deal. One of the things that I did, because I had been so accustomed to having somebody to talk to and bounce things off of, I organized a board of directors. Even though we were a private company, I recruited 5 or 6 prominent business people, and they became members of my board, so I would have somebody to meet with.
Was it a paid board of directors or volunteer?
Paid. And to discuss various issues with. And that proved to be very valuable. And then when we became public, these people remained as our directors.
When did you go public?
We went public in 1996.
Interstate Hotels
Interstate
went
Hotels.
Public.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Was that hard to launch?
I had always resisted going public because I preferred being private. I tend to be a private person, and I function better that way. And if you're a private company, you make decisions that seem sensible to you. If you're a public company, you always have to keep one eye peeled on what will analysts think of it, what will your stockholders think. So it affects your decision making, sometimes not for the best. So being private was fine with me. I was happy to be private. But in the 1990s, a number of things happened. There, public companies in the hotel business were very hot, and they were worth more than private companies. So by being public, we were able to increase our value, really. Secondly, we had acquired a great deal of real estate, hotel real estate, with another company, and we had an option to buy out their interest, and it was very important for us to do that, and going public was the best way to get the capital to do that. So for that and for many good reasons, we decided to go public, and in truth that turned out to be a very good move for us.
So what was the other company that you bought then?
Well, the company that we had purchased real estate with was a company called Blackstone. They were a venture capital company. And if we hadn't purchased those hotels, they might have sold them to somebody else, and that would have hurt Interstate a great deal, because they would have lost a lot of the hotels. But by going public, we were able to get the capital to buy them back. And if you took, at that time, a group of assets, hotel assets, and put them in a public basket, they were worth more than they were individually, because there was a lot of growth occurring, and from a value point of view, that turned out to be an excellent move. We enhanced our value by going public. Then 2 years later, when I perceived that the market had turned negative, or was about to turn negative.
How were you that bright to perceive that?
You know, I think anybody could have perceived it, but most people didn't pay attention to it because they didn't want to believe that change was happening. And we've never been geniuses, but we've always been very realistic. And we look and see what's out there in the market, and we react to it. We don't kid ourselves about what's happening. So I don't think you need a crystal ball. I think you just need to see what's there and draw the necessary conclusions. And we did that, and I perceived that we were pretty much at the peak. And so I decided it was a good time to sell. And we did sell, and in truth, the market went down a great deal after that.
And you sold to?
We sold to a company called Patriot America. It's now called Wyndham.
Tell us about
Wyndham.
Wyndham.
Oh, Wyndham.
Tell us about Patriot America.
Well, Patriot was a company that was known as a REIT, R-E-I-T, Real Estate Investment Trust. And they had acquired a great deal of hotel real estate. And they were growing tremendously. REITs were very highly valued on Wall Street. And they were very anxious to continue to grow. Interstate was quite a plum for them because we had a lot of hotel real estate, had a management business, and we really negotiated with several possible buyers at that time, but Patriot was, in the end, the buyer that was willing to pay the most money and the buyer that was real.
And that was a substantial sale.
It was over $2 billion. Right.
For Interstate.
Right.
Wow. And then Wyndham bought Patriot American?
No, Patriot changed their name.
Oh,
to Wyndham.
I'm sorry.
They ceased being a REIT and they became a hotel company.
Now, just if you could give us an idea, in the hotel industry, when you sold Interstate, and you sold, I mean, in Interstate, although it was public then, it went for about $2 billion. How does this compare to some of the other very large hotel chains or...
Well, for example, when Starwood acquired Sheraton, I think they paid about $13 billion for that.
For Sheraton.
For Sheraton, right. So...
And Hilton is...
And Hilton is much bigger.
Sure.
Interstate ranked just under the major companies like Marriott, Hilton, Sheraton. But it was quite up there. It was a very substantial company.
Of course.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And so now your status is...
Well, having sold the company, I have now set up a small company of my own, and I'm still in the hotel business. We bought some hotels, and we have built some hotels, and are in the process of continuing to do that. We recently opened a hotel in Providence, Rhode Island, which I know quite a bit about. And last year we opened one in downtown Chicago.
And what's the name of that?
It's a Hilton. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at projects in various places.
Well, I know, Milt, from interviewing you last time that you were born in...
East Pittsburgh.
No. In the year 26,
right.
So you obviously aren't ready to slow down at all, and at your age now?
I really have never had much of an interest in retirement. I think retirement is something that you do when you can't work anymore. To me, work is a lot of fun, and I enjoy it. And yet I've never been a workaholic.
Never? Even in...
No.
Oh, really?
No. I always give myself lots of time to do the things that I want to do. Travel, sports, whatever. But all of those things are more pleasant when you're also working. I think if you're doing nothing but traveling or nothing but playing golf, it can get fairly boring. And I find work stimulating, challenging. So I continue to do it. My intention is to go on doing it as long as I'm capable.
Wonderful. Do you still have any interest at all, are you on the boards of the Wyndham or any of the...
I'm on the board of Wyndham.
Uh-huh.
And I'm on the board of a venture capital firm that's part of Citicorp. Until a couple of weeks ago, I was chairman of the Carnegie Museum of Art.
Well, that's what we want to get into right now. If you would, tell us
some now. Are you interested in art and how you developed all this?
That has sort of been a second career for me. I started collecting art in the late 1970s, also more or less by accident. I was in Paris I walked past a gallery and impulsively saw a piece of art in the window that I liked, and I went in and I bought it. And it cost a fair amount of money. And after I bought it, I said to myself, if I'm going to do this, I better learn something about art. And I came home and I started learning about art.
And you never had that much of an interest?
My interest, I had an interest, but it was fairly slight. You know, like other people in Pittsburgh, I would occasionally go to the Pittsburgh Plant for Art, or Pittsburgh Art Center, or the Carnegie, mm-hmm. you know, to look at exhibits. When I was in the Army, I would go to the Louvre in Paris and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I never really... Mm-hmm. Seriously collected or had a strong interest. And then, at any rate, I did begin to learn about art. I read about it. I got more involved with the Carnegie and met some of their curators and went to auctions, began to educate myself about the art market, the economics of art. By looking at more art and good art, you begin to train your taste. Just like a doctor who's accustomed to operating, you know, gets to know one appendix from another. He can look at an appendix and tell you a lot about it. But that only comes from experience. Same thing with looking at art. If you look at good art in a lot of museums, you can tell the difference between good art and not such good art. Just by comparison.
Do you have a your personal interests in art are more...
It's contemporary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's sort of happenstance. I like other kinds of art. But when you collect contemporary art, you're sort of in touch with your own period. Mm-hmm. You have an opportunity to talk to artists. Impressionism is wonderful, but you can't talk to Degas, Matisse, unfortunately. And besides, those things were incredibly expensive. They cost millions of dollars for each piece. So I've enjoyed collecting contemporary art. And through that, I became more and more involved in the Carnegie and became a trustee there. And about 8 years ago, I became chairman.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your being chairperson? And
well, I felt that one of the most important things that I could do was to make sure that the museum had very good professionals. And so I was always very involved in helping to select the director of the museum, the curators, helping to counsel them on how to do their jobs more effectively, and in trying to bring the Carnegie Museum more in sync with this period where it's necessary to be more open, more accessible. You know, museums used to be sort of monumental, both in architecture and in attitude. And they probably frightened a lot of people away. Sort of a hush when you go into a museum. And I think today the attitude is different. That museums ought to be places that are fun, people can learn, but learn in an entertaining way and have a good time and be themselves.
So that was one of your biggest goals?
And that was a very important goal, and that, mm-hmm. that has happened a great deal mm-hmm. and is continuing to happen. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Carnegie is a different place today mm-hmm. than it was mm-hmm. 10 or 15 years ago.
Who do you think were some of the very important people we've had here?
Well, we right now, the director is Richard Armstrong. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely outstanding. He's very knowledgeable. He's very open. He's an outstanding leader. I enjoyed working with him. And I enjoyed the process of his becoming director. Other directors who are excellent is Jack Lane, some of the outstanding curators, but John Caldwell. Our most recent curator, Madeline Grinstein, was a wonderful teacher and mentor.
What about when people say we're, often the jumping off place for them to leave for San Francisco or somewhere? Is that a...
No. As far as curators are concerned, mm-hmm. probably the most important thing that happens at the Carnegie is the international, which occurs every 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's the largest show of its kind in the world, where outstanding contemporary art from all over the world mm-hmm. is brought here to Pittsburgh. And people come here from all over the world, mm-hmm. Europe and Asia. Pittsburgh is known probably around the world more for the Carnegie International than for anything else. And if you're a curator and it's your job to put that show together, it's hard to do it more than once. It's a backbreaking job where you travel the world many times. So curators frequently are here for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and they do an international, and then it's time for them to move on, because it's just not really feasible for them to do it again, and that's why Madeline really...
And what do you think she most brought to this past international?
Madeline is a very unique and wonderful person. She really had a way of making art intelligible to everybody. She had a way of explaining things, of translating art into the kind of language and the kind of idiom that people understand and feel good about. So she was able to produce a show, an exhibition, that was a tremendous hit with the critics, and at the same time attracted large, enthusiastic audiences. And she's now moved on to a bigger museum in San Francisco, and I think that she will in due course become a director. I think she has that ability. She's a rising star in the museum field.
How does our museum compare to others now in the top ones?
There was a recent article in Travel Magazine evaluating museums around the world, and I think the Carnegie was rated number 18, which is not bad.
For the size of the community.
Or what? For the size of this community in the world. It's certainly not as big or as well funded as the Museum of Modern Art or the Louvre or the Metropolitan, but considering where it is and the audience it serves, it's a very strong museum. With an especially outstanding program in contemporary art, but a good program in various fields too.
Do you think there are areas that we could go, directions that we should be going that we haven't?
Well, the museum needs to do things to the building to make it more accessible, and there are plans to do that. It's a very old building. It's a wonderful building. Mm. But it's time to bring it up to date. When you walk into that building, if you haven't been there before, it's hard to figure out how to get to the Museum of Natural History, how to get to the Museum of Art, how to get to specific exhibits. The flow of traffic needs to be much more comprehensible. And it needs to be more open, as I just discussed. And the museum is working very hard to bring that about. And I think in the next few years, you're going to see very good changes. Still maintaining the grandeur of the building, but making it more accessible and more comprehensible to people who want to enjoy the museum.
Okay. I see that you were the recipient of an award for the cultural arts.
I think the it's the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts.
Oh.
Makes an award every year to people who have contributed to the arts in this region. And for one reason or another, they chose me. I guess it was about 4 or 5 years ago.
Nice. Have you had other honors that you would like to share with us?
I was just at the University of Pittsburgh. I was named a Legacy Laureate. Roughly translated, it's distinguished alumni. And actually, I had to make a speech to some of the students there, and I opened my speech by thanking the university for having named me a Legacy Laureate. And then I commented,